Excuse me, this is the conference operator. I'd like to inform all participants that today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objection, you may disconnect. Thank you, and you may begin when ready.
Okay, thank you. So welcome, everyone, to the Cassini 7th Anniversary Charm Telecon. We've got four speakers today. Amanda Hendricks will give a mission overview, followed by Norbert Krupp, who will give the overview of the magnetospheric science, and then Andy Ingersoll, who will give us an overview of the Saturn science, and Zibby or Elizabeth Turtle, who will give us the highlights of Titan and the IC satellites. So hopefully you've been able to download all the material from the password-protected website. And with that, we'll start the telecon with Amanda. Let me give her a little bit of an introduction. Amanda Hendricks is from JPL, and she's the Cassini Deputy Project Scientist, and she's also a UVIS co-investigator. UVIS is the ultraviolet imaging spectrograph. And from her role as our Deputy Project Scientist, she's going to give you a bit of an overview of the Cassini mission and plans to come. So with that, Amanda?
Okay, great. So thanks for calling in, everybody. I guess we'll just go ahead and jump in here, and we'll kind of start on slide three. And some of you who have called into this telecon, especially the anniversary one over the years, might see some things that have come up year after year, but it's just kind of an overview and nice to remind ourselves about the history of the mission and the history of you know, solar system discoveries and why we named the mission, the Cassini-Huygens mission. After Christian Huygens and Giovanni Domenico Cassini, Huygens was a Dutch scientist who discovered the true nature of Saturn's rings, in other words, why Saturn looks so bizarre and odd from the initial ground-based observations, so that there's actually a ring system, and also discovered Titan. And then Cassini did further observations of the ring system and discovered the Cassini division and also discovered several of Saturn's major moons. So on the next slide are the spacecraft themselves, the Cassini orbiter, and you can see there on the left, this is obviously pre-launch and there's some people standing around, and so you can get an idea really of how big this thing is. We always say it's as big as a school bus. And there on the right is the Huygens probe, and on the left you can see the Huygens probe there with the sort of gold foil on it to get an idea of how big that is. Next slide. Here's some stats on the spacecraft. Again, this might be a review for some of you, but the instruments, let's just go into the instruments that are on the orbiter itself, are listed down here at the bottom. We have the remote sensing instruments, or ORS instruments, SEERS, ISS, UVIS, and VIMS. Then we have the radar and radio science, or RSS, and the MAPS instruments, the magnetospheric and plasma science instruments, CAP, CDA, INMS, MAG, MIMI, and RPWS. And so today and also next month when we continue our anniversary telecon, you'll hear about results from all of these instruments. And also just a reminder on the next slide that where a lot of the work is done and where the sort of teams are based, all over the world really, RSS and radar here at JPL, VIMS in Arizona, ISS and UVIS in Boulder, CAPS and INMS in San Antonio, RPWS in Iowa, and SEERS and MIMI in the Baltimore area. And then MAG in the UK and CDA in Germany. And on the next slide, you get an idea of how really international the participation is on Cassini, because there's scientists working on the data and participating in the mission from a number of countries all over the world. So that makes it really nice. On slide eight, in terms of the numbers, we've got five scientific disciplines, Saturn, Titan, rings, icy satellites, and the magnetosphere. And so these are the topics that you'll be hearing about. 18 instruments, 12 on the orbiter that I've already listed. And then we've got about 30 members of the Project Science Group executive group. And so this is the main sort of science group decision makers on the project. At each PSG meeting, in the plenary sessions, we'll have about 80 to 100 scientists participating. And about 270 scientists on all the investigation teams, with more than half of those being in Europe. So then on top of it, we've got team associates and postdocs, and so really there's lots of people working on the data, which is great. And also, the really neat thing for this year is that there was just this year in 2011, there was the first call for participating scientists on Cassini. So this is a brand new program, and so scientists have submitted proposals. They were just due earlier this month, I believe. And so those will be reviewed, and probably about 10 new participating scientists will be chosen. And these are people who will participate actively as part of the Cassini team, especially in analysis of data. And so that's really exciting. I think we're all looking forward to having some new blood aboard. Okay, slide 9. Here's the Smithsonian system. And again, you've seen these graphics before. It's just a sort of representative of the different aspects of the system, the moons, the rings, and the planet itself. What we can't really see so much here is the magnetosphere, but it envelops, of course, the planet and the rings and all the moons itself. And there's all sorts of really different interesting interactions between all the different aspects of the system. And so, again, you'll hear about those types of things later today and next month. A lot of the results that you'll be hearing about are from the Prime mission and the Equinox mission. So the Equinox mission we have just completed in the fall. This, of course, was our first extended mission. It was 2.25 years, which followed the Prime mission, which was 4 years. And it took us through Saturn Equinox. That's why it's called the Equinox mission, and that was in August of 2009. Now, this was this 2.25 years of extended mission were very busy, and there was a lot of science observations happening similar to the intensity of the Prime mission. And so it produced a maximum scientific return possible. And this is in contrast to the extended mission or the Solstice mission that we'll talk about in a little bit. So slide 11, the Equinox mission overview. So in the last 2.5 years or so, we had 26 Titan flybys of different geometries. We had 7 Enceladus flybys, less than about 2,000 kilometers, again, at different geometries. We had, on top of that, additional icy satellite flybys and the small rocky satellite flybys. We did 3 ANSA-to-ANSA ring and Saturn radio science occultations, and also a high number of mid-latitude northern hemisphere Saturn occultations. There was a lack of high northern latitude occultations that we'll try to get back in the Solstice mission. And then there were 5 dedicated targeted Saturn periapsis passages. In other words, we were focused on the planet itself and not doing other things like we sometimes do, like look at icy satellites. So that was really good. And also there were 28 orbits with high inclination, higher than about 64 degrees, which enables the instruments to look down on the ring system, look down at the northern latitudes of the planet and the satellites, and also get a good sampling of the magnetospheric environment at high inclinations. And that inclination profile is shown on the next slide, slide 12, for the Equinox mission, the 2 years of it. So we started out at high inclination, and then as the inclination was decreased was when we Saturn went through Equinox. And then except for sort of this transfer period where we popped up in inclination, we were at low inclination and did a lot of icy satellite flybys last year, and that's when we did those ANSA-to-ANSA occultations as well. Slide 13 is the chart showing the overview, especially of the satellite flybys and the number of orbits in each year of the 4 years of the Prime mission, and then the 2 years of the extended mission, just to kind of give you an overview there. Next slide, the Equinox science objectives were to focus, number one, on new discoveries, including things like the Enceladus plumes and Titan's interesting and complex surface that we had discovered in the Prime mission, and also to make theoretical advances, such as, you know, looking for understanding the dynamics of satellites embedded in the rings and satellite geophysics, such as the Iapetus equatorial ridge, and then to look for brand new activities and get temporal and spatial coverage. So throughout the Equinox mission, we were looking at new seasons, especially important for Titan and Saturn. And then Equinox was really important for studying the ring system and the effects of the rings on the planet. And then new places to explore in the huge magnetosphere, which is constantly evolving. And then the AO, the announcement of opportunity, objectives from the very beginning of the Cassini mission, we still had objectives that we needed to address, and in particular, increasing the Titan coverage by radar, which was increased to about 30%. And also looking ahead to future missions, just increasing our knowledge so that we can gather information for possible future missions to Titan and Enceladus. So those were the main objectives of the Equinox mission. And so I think you'll hear about science results addressing each of those later today and next month also. The 7 Enceladus flybys in the Equinox mission are kind of shown in kind of a sketch on slide 15, showing the trajectories in each of the different colored lines relative to Enceladus and its giant south polar plume. So you can see that there were a variety of different geometries there, which is really helpful. First of all, we need to get the temporal coverage, so we need to have, fly-throughs of the plume as frequently as we can, but then also to get different geometries is really important, too, to understand the distribution of the particles and the gas. So you can see that we had some relatively high-inclination fly-throughs and some that were very low-inclination or sort of horizontal cuts through the plume. So now we're in the Solstice mission. As of last fall, we're in the extended mission, which is called the Solstice mission because it is going to take us all the way through summer solstice on the northern hemisphere. So recall that when we arrived at Saturn in 2004, it was southern summer, and so this will take us all the way through northern summer, which is really important for studying seasonal variations on kind of all the aspects of the system. And I'll also point out that it gets us a lot of coverage through the solar cycle, which we're seeing effects of as well. So the Solstice mission on slide 17 is October 11, 2010 through September 15 of 2017. And here now we're operating on a reduced budget. And so we've simplified our operations plan. And this is in contrast to the high-intensity, high-activity mode of doing things in the Prime and Equinox mission. So, but nevertheless, we have lots of things happening, like 38 Titan flybys that are closer than about 2,000 kilometers, 54 targeted flybys in total. We've got 12 close Enceladus flybys and further icy satellite flybys like Dione and Rhea. Lots of solar and stellar occultations at a variety of latitudes to get further coverage there. Also, further targeted, dedicated Saturn periapsis passages and incline sequences. And the inclination profile is shown on slide 18 for the entire Solstice mission. And we've broken it up into kind of four segments. So we are now in equatorial one, kind of segment where we've got low inclination. And as you can see, there's a lot of Enceladus and also Titan flybys in this equatorial one phase. Next year, we'll be heading into the inclined one phase where we go way up to high inclination and also do a lot of Titan flybys there, but also kind of map out, like I said, the magnetosphere and get good views of the high latitudes of the planet and the satellites and the magnetosphere. Mm-hmm. Then we have a shorter equatorial 2 phase, and then go up again to an inclined phase, the inclined 2 segment. Slide 19 shows all the flybys since the beginning of the Prime mission all the way through the Equinox mission, and gives you an idea of what we're going to do in terms of Titan flybys by year, and also Enceladus flybys and all the other guys throughout the Solstice mission. And also, what's nice is it shows you that Saturn, kind of a scene from the sun, but it gives you an idea of how open the rings are and what hemisphere of Saturn is facing the sun. So the scientific objectives for the Solstice mission are primarily to look at seasonal and temporal changes on Saturn, on the rings, to observe magnetospheric variations over the solar cycle, any seasonal variations on the icy satellites, and long-term variations as well, and also on Titan. And then the second big objective is to answer new questions. So we've got newly discovered atmospheric waves at Saturn, a South Polar hurricane. I'm sure you'll hear about this giant northern hemisphere storm. All these things that we need to continue tracking on Saturn and see how they evolve. And then there's ring dynamical features such as the propellers, the fans, and the F-ring that are important to keep tracking and keep observing to understand them a little bit better. And also, for instance, to make further observations of Dione and see whether it exhibits evidence for low-level activity like we have hints of. And so my final slide is slide 21, and it just kind of gives an overview of some of the highlights, the recent highlights in the different areas. So we've got Mimas in the upper left, which shows this bizarre thermal anomaly. It makes it look like Pac-Man. This is very unexpected, and so you'll probably hear more about that. Recently, we did a close flyby of Helene, which is one of Dione's co-orbitals, and it turns out that it is really not only just beautiful, but really fascinating, the surface features and the surface structure that we see on it. Recently, a collaborative effort among the MAPS instruments discovered a footprint at the northern auroral region of Saturn from the moon Enceladus. And so this is an interesting electrical connection between the two that you'll hear more about. A really important paper came out about rain, evidence for rain on the surface of Titan that you'll hear about, and that's shown here kind of in the middle left, a darkening of the surface, probably because of rain after a storm. There are these bizarre F-ring fans, and a nice, beautiful, giant storm on Saturn in the northern hemisphere that evidently began last December and continues on, that Cassini is continuing to track. So I will let the next speaker go ahead and leave it at that, and I'll stay on for a while in case anybody has any questions.
That's great. Thank you, Amanda. Does anyone have questions for Amanda?
This is Lynn in the Netherlands. Yeah, I have one question.
Okay, go ahead.
Regarding the plumes on Enceladus, I remember a discussion a couple of years ago about whether the plumes were caused by actually liquid water reservoirs or outgassing from the ice, and I was wondering if the recent flybys have settled that question.
You know, I think we've gotten a lot more data on it from the different flybys, and there's a lot more evidence for the liquid water source. And you'll probably hear more about this from Zibby Turtle, but in particular, I think one of the smoking gun pieces of evidence was from the CDA, because they have measured not only the dust, the plume dust grain sizes, but composition, and are showing sodium-rich particles and larger, more sodium-rich particles closer to the surface of Enceladus, but in the plume. And so this is the type of composition that you'd expect if it were from a liquid water source. So that's one of the smoking guns. So I think that a lot of people are in agreement that there's got to be some sort of a liquid water source in the subsurface. Whether that means a global ocean or not is still under debate.
Any other questions for Amanda? So I noticed you didn't talk about how we plan to end the mission. Maybe that's because it hasn't been really approved, I guess, by NASA headquarters. But
that's
really
right.
So you, yeah. But the idea, I guess, is to go really close to the planet in these high inclination orbits, which people, scientists, are really excited about. So.
Oh yeah.
I guess we'll hear about that.
And so basically it's still sort of in as a proposal currently made to NASA headquarters, but it still needs to be approved. But it is to do a series of relatively high inclination, but very close in between the planet and the innermost D-ring, and which will be absolutely fabulous, especially for Saturn and magnetospheric and ring science. So we're working on planning those further, but I think it'll be probably some time before we get final approval for that. So,
yeah. That'll be great if we do. Any other questions for Amanda? Okay. Well, thank you very much, Amanda. That was great. So the next presentation is Norbert Krupp, and hopefully you've downloaded his presentation from the website. And are you still with us, Norbert?
Yes.
I hope I'm not butchering your name. I used to always pronounce it in my California accent, Krupp, and my German colleagues just chastised me for that. So I think it's more correct to say Norbert Krupp, right?
Yeah, it's more Krupp, but it doesn't matter.
Okay. All right. So Norbert is our next speaker, and his presentation has his last name on it, so hopefully everyone has found it. And I think you've got one movie in your presentation, and we're just going to click on the link. Is that right, Norbert?
Yeah, I mean, there's one movie which you will not be able to study directly in the presentation, but on the CHARM website you will find it, and you can, I mean, I put just two shots from that movie on that one slide just to give you an idea, but if you want to see the full movie, please just use that link on that slide.
Okay, that's great. Let me give you a brief introduction. Our next speaker is Dr. Norbert Krupp from the Max Planck Institute for Solar System Research in a very nice part of Germany, Katlenberg-Lindau. He's a co-investigator on the Magnetospheric Imaging Instrument, MIMI, and he's also now the co-chair of the Cassini Magnetospheres Discipline Working Group. The presentation with K-R-U-P-P, Krupp, in the title. And with that, Norbert, go ahead.
Thank you, Marsha. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm going to give you a short introduction about the magnetospheric and the magnetic environment of Saturn and what the new findings of Cassini gave us insight about. So on the second slide, you see, first of all, the acknowledgement. So I want to really point out that this is not my presentation. It's just a summary of all the presentation and the material which I got from a various amount of people, which are, some of them are listed here, but maybe I forgot a few. So it's the entire Cassini MAPS instruments and members of the MAPS group which provided material for that talk. So on the next slide, you see what I want to give you a short overview of. First of all, since not all of you are familiar with magnetospheres, I will give you a short introduction about what it's all about, and then give you some insight about what Cassini found in terms of the global configuration of the magnetosphere and its dynamics, as well as some of the interactions of this magnetospheric plasma and the rings and the moons. So in the next slide, I start with the introduction and just go on to the slide number 5. So what is a magnetosphere? This is a very brief introduction of what we talk about. So just on the left side, you see what normally a magnetic field would look like of a planet. So it would be looking like a dipole you are familiar with from your school physics courses. So you would simply see the dipole field lines coming out from one side, from the north or from the south, depending on the direction of the dipole, and go into the other hemisphere. So, but because we have the solar wind, which is this amount of particles which come out of the sun regularly, this is disturbing this normal, very symmetric magnetic field lines, and you end up with what we call a magnetosphere. So it's a highly disturbed region around the planet, which is dominated by the planetary magnetic field. And so you see that it is slightly pushed towards the planet on the solar-facing side, and it's highly extended on the other side from the sun. So we talk about a magnetotail on the other side compared to the sun's direction, so which is highly extended. So if you go to the next slide, you see that you know how a magnetosphere will look like in the interplanetary space. So you see here the sun on the left, which is rotating and has its interplanetary magnetic fields, and this solar wind plasma, which is essentially charged hydrogen atoms and electrons out of the sun, are radially transported out of the sun. And, of course, if these particles hit this dipole of a planet, then this magnetosphere is formed, and you see this in the case for the Earth in that slide. But how about the sizes, and what is the size of these magnetospheres? And this is in the next slide. So the size of the magnetosphere is very, very large. So you see here that we categorize all the magnetospheres we know today into small, intermediate, and huge magnetospheres. And if you just click one slide further, you see what we are talking about today, which is the magnetosphere of Saturn. It's the second largest magnetosphere in our solar system. And if you would compare it to the size of the sun, you see it on the right-hand side, this black dot is the size of the solar disk in comparison to the magnetospheres of Jupiter and Saturn. And you see immediately that this is a very enormous entity in the interplanetary space where a lot of plasma processes are proceeding and are ongoing, and this is where we need these instrumentations, what we call the particles and fields instruments, on a mission like Cassini to find out these processes taking place in the magnetosphere, because it's not visible. You can only see it with our particle instrumentations. So if you go on the next slide, of course, we have to talk a little bit about physics when we talk about particles in the magnetosphere. And essentially, most of the particles we find in magnetospheres are charged, but also, of course, a lot of neutrals, especially for Saturn. And these charged particles are somehow doing particle motion in the magnetosphere in combination with their charge and the magnetic field of the planet. And we, in the particle community, we somehow distinguish between essentially three different types of motions of these particles. One is the gyro motion around the magnetic field, as you all know about from the physics course. The second one is what we call the bounce motion, where those particles are bouncing back and forth between the northern and the southern hemisphere along the field line. And they change their orientation and go back and forth, and this is what we call a sort of a trapped particle distribution along those field lines. And the third motion is perpendicular to these magnetic field lines, what we call the drift. And all these three motions, they, of course, can also be described in terms of adiabatic invariance, what we call it. And these are some of the very important aspects of what we will talk about in the next slides. So if you go to the next slide, I just summarized what particles instruments in a magnetosphere will measure and what we are interested in. So first of all, of course, we would like to know what particle species and charge states are available and are measurable in the vicinity of the planets. And so we can distinguish between ions, eventually also with different charge states, and electrons, and also the amount of those particles. So another parameter which we are measuring are these, what we call a differential particle intensity, I, which are the particles which we measure in a specific energy interval per second and per unit sphere angle, which is essentially the opening angle of our particle instrument on the spacecraft. Very important to know is not only one energy range and the number of particles in that energy range, but the entire energy spectrum. And therefore, if we can measure those amount of particles in different particle energy ranges, then we can tell a lot of and can try to explain a lot of those processes going on in the magnetospheres. So we distinguish between what we call a low energy spectrum, which can be described by a Maxwellian distribution, and a higher energy part of the energy spectrum, which is normally described in terms of a power law type of a distribution. A power law is nothing else than simply the exponent of this description of the intensity as a function of energy to the power of what we call an exponent of a power law. So another very important aspect is pitch angle, and we will talk about pitch angle in some of the slides, which you will see very soon. And this is nothing else than the angle between the direction of the magnetic field itself and the motion of the particles. So if we talk about a pitch angle of zero, this means that those particles really fly along the magnetic field lines in the same direction as the magnetic field is pointing. And also a phase-based density, which is something which is even more interesting in terms of physics, because this is a quantity independent of any coordinate system where you are in the magnetosphere. So if you go to the next slide, I'm listing here all the MAPS instrumentations. You will see a few results of, and Amanda has already shown those. So it's the magnetometer, and then a set of particle and fields instrumentation able to measure energy and different species, electrons and ions in the different energy ranges, as well as neutral particles, so which are at no charge. Then we have the radio and plasma wave spectrometer, RPWS, where we are able to also measure the result of those particles moving along the field lines, because they emit radio and plasma waves along their way around the magnetic field. And then, of course, we have the cosmic dust analyzer, CDA. And in addition to all these normal MAPS instrumentations, I've listed here also the UVIS, the ultraviolet imaging spectrometer, because, in a sense, this is also a MAPS instrument, and you will see one of the major results of the recent year, that it is a combination of all the particle fields and the UV spectrometer, because, for example, in the UV range, you can observe the aurora of Saturn very nicely, and we know that these electrons in the energy range of a few keV to MeV, the ones which are responsible for these emissions in the aurora. If you go to the next slide, you see an image of the Saturn's magnetosphere. This is a very nice image of the magnetosphere before Cassini arrived, actually, at Saturn. And you see what a magnetosphere is all about. So you see in gray, these are sort of magnetic field lines coming out of the northern part of the planet sitting in the center. Here you see some of these white lines, which should be the orbits of some of the inner moons, the icy satellites, where Sibi is going to talk about later today. And you see this reddish stuff, and this is what we basically call the plasma disk or the plasma sheet of a magnetosphere. This is essentially charged particles which are rotating with the planet, and are, due to the centrifugal force, are stretched out far down the tail, but essentially only along the equatorial plane of that planet. In addition, you see in more purple color, you see that before Cassini arrived at Saturn, people thought that Titan plays a much more important role for the magnetosphere and for the material found in the magnetosphere than actually Cassini found, and we'll hear about this later. If you go onto the next slide, you see some of the questions and some of the new results just put onto that slide after Cassini, and you see immediately that there's, for example, the question, where is the nitrogen? And this nitrogen was the major source was thought to come from Titan, but there's not very much nitrogen found in the magnetosphere. Instead, what is really found by Cassini is that Enceladus, this very tiny little moon you heard about already in Amanda's talk, is the mass source of the magnetosphere itself. It produces about 100 to 300 kilograms per second of these water molecules coming out of those tiger stripes. And, of course, this material is then transported all the way inside the magnetosphere, and the magnetosphere, as it is listed on the upper part of the slide, is swimming in water. The magnetosphere is really dominated by water molecules, which are essentially ice particles in the magnetosphere. So you see this very nice figure has already modified slightly by some of the results from Cassini. So if you go into the next slide, or just continue onto the next slide, which is the one about the neutral gas, already during the approach of Cassini towards the magnetosphere, there were already some of the measurements from this UVIS instrument presented, and they were clearly showing that they see already far away from the planet, they see a cloud of neutral particles sitting around the magnetosphere and even beyond the magnetosphere in interplanetary space. So this image on the right-hand side, all this pinkish emission, which is showing you a region around Saturn, plus minus 45 Saturnian radii around the planet, shows simply hydrogen gas, which is coming out of the system. And already from that image, we knew right away, and of course we knew this partially before, that the neutral gas is very important in all aspects in the Saturnian magnetosphere, and it has about 100 times more neutral particles as compared to to Jupiter. If you go into the next slide and the upper next, you'll see how a normal orbit or one of the orbits of Cassini in terms of the magnetospheric science look like. So what you see here is the first orbit, so it's Saturn insertion orbit, and you see in color here the amount of particles which are measured along the trajectory of Cassini by flying in and out of the magnetosphere. So you see some of these white lines indicate the crossings of the boundary between the interplanetary space and the magnetosphere, what we call the magnetopause. But you also see that the intensity, which is the color, changes from being blue or greenish to red or even white. And this tells us that wherever you are in the magnetosphere, there is a different number of particles and different electrons and ions are different in where you are in the magnetosphere. And this is exactly what we would like to know. So we are able, by flying through the magnetosphere, to really determine the size and the composition and also the various different regions with different processes in the magnetosphere. So if you continue on to the next slide, you see already one of the very early and very exciting new results of Cassini during that insertion orbit, because the insertion orbit was very special in the sense that it was at the time and up to now actually the closest flyby at Saturn inside what we call the main radiation belt. So we were able to look with all our particles and instruments towards the planet by having the main radiation belts behind us. And so we looked into a region where no other spacecraft so far was able to look into. And, of course, we discovered something new. And you see that in this image here, which is published in a science presentation, in a science paper by Grimitis in 2005, because there is a discovery of a new radiation belt. So you see here on the right-hand side, the reddish part where these magnetic field lines are drawn onto, this is what we call a normal radiation belt, and also the extension we knew before Cassini arrived there. But inside these rings, the visible rings, which you know from looking at Saturn, we discovered a new radiation belt inside the innermost, which is the D ring, very close to Saturn. And this was only possible because we did not yet fly through that region directly, but we were able to remotely sense the particles coming from that region inside of the main radiation belt due to some charge exchange processes where a charged particle gets neutralized, and this neutral particle is able then to disappear and to come towards Cassini again, where you can measure the emission from these ENAs, from where you can really determine how much particles have to sit in that region in order to get these results in our particle detector. So this is already very early in the mission, one of the highlights in terms of magnetospheric physics, that we discovered a new radiation belt. If you go to the next slide, of course, as time goes by, we were able now to map out essentially all the radiation belts, I mean, the ones outside the D-ring, completely. And what you see here is simply an image of the radiation belt of Saturn. So red means there's a lot of particles present. Blue means there's about three orders of magnitude less particles present. And these are real measurements. So we were able to determine really the size and also the intensity at various locations relative to the planet itself, the amount of particles sitting there. And this is very important for a spacecraft, for example, because this is what we call the radiation of which are harmful to all electronics on the spacecraft. So we need to know where we should avoid flying through in order to have a spacecraft healthy for a very long time. If you look really careful, you immediately see that this is not a continuous radiation belt, but there are gaps in between. And these gaps in between, they are connected to the orbital motion and to the orbits of the moons going through these radiation belts. So these moons act as sort of vacuum cleaners. They eat up those particles in these areas all the way along their orbit, all the way around the planet. So if you go on to the next slide, this is a little bit better illustrated in that slide, where you see that the amount of particles directly at the orbits of the various moons, Janus, Mimas, Enceladus, and Tethys, are simply removed from the normal distribution. So if there would be no moons, you would see one big increase of the particle intensity until you reach the planet or until you reach the rings, essentially. But due to those moons, you see the bite-outs in between, and this is what we call a macro signature of a particle distribution in a magnetosphere. So if you go onto the next slide, you see that those radiation belts with all the gaps in between, they are also variable. And there was a very nice result later in the mission. After about 50 orbits, we were able to really say that these radiation belts are not always the same, but once in a while, if something happens in the interplanetary medium, like, for example, a big mass ejection from the Sun arriving at Saturn's magnetosphere, there is an additional transient belt appearing and then going away after time, after a few weeks' time, later on. And this is illustrated in that slide here, where you see that the white and the yellow curve is the normal radiation belt distribution, what I've shown to you in the slide before. But this blue one, this turquoise-bluish one, is a new one. And this is a belt which appeared and then suddenly disappeared after a few weeks. And this is something which has not been observed before because, of course, Cassini is the first orbiting spacecraft at Saturn. So you see that also those radiation belts are highly variable. So, of course, in the next slide, you can then, of course, ask the question, where do all these particles come from in the radiation belts? Because normally, if there is just, one radiation belt appearing once in a while at a different location, you have to ask yourself, where are these particles are coming from? And what you see here is one of those energy spectrums. So you see the intensity, the amount of particles per square centimeter, second, and steradian, and energy interval as a function of energy. And you immediately see that this is an additional peak at about 10 to the 4 keV. And this is what we call a Grand peak. So Grand is simply standing for cosmic ray and neutral albedo decay. And this is nothing else than the interaction between galactic cosmic rays and the rings of the Saturnian system, creating those particles, in this case protons, appearing at a very specific energy. So this is one of the sources of the inner radiation belts. It's coming from the galactic cosmic rays, while all the others are not really fully understood, I must say. So we are still working on that. It's hard to understand why there are particles in this energy range between 100 and 1,000 keV, but we try to understand this, and with more data we will be able to say a little more than what we know right now. So if you go to the next, and then the upper next slide, you see that the second question we ask by looking at magnetospheres, what is the charge states and the composition of the energetic ions which we are able to measure with these particles? And for the first time, we were able in an outer planet's magnetosphere with Cassini, with one of the MIMI instruments, to distinguish not only the ions from the electrons, but also charge states of various ions from each other. So what you see on the left here is simply a mass versus mass per charge diagram, where they cluster different charge states of various ions in various regions on this matrix. And if you simply sum up all the points in these ellipses and put them as a function of mass per charge on the right-hand side of this figure, you see really the a histogram of the amount of different charge states and ions in the magnetosphere. And you immediately see that besides the protons, which is this H+, in the magnetosphere coming from essentially the solar wind, we see a big peak in a region of heavy material around what we call the water group ion line, which is mass 18. So we see an H2O+ peak as well as an O+ and an OH+. And this pointed already in a direction that there has to be a source inside the magnetosphere providing us with this amount of material, and we all know already now that this is Enceladus. If you go to the next slide, by having more and more data coming in, you were able to look at the details and the distribution as a function of distance from Saturn and the distance in terms from the equator to define really the distribution, and this is shown here in these two slides. So this water group ion density is shown here in color. So you see immediately Enceladus sits at a location of about 4 Saturn radii here, and outside of that distance to bigger values, to bigger distances from the planet, you see that there is a sort of a cloud emanating radially outward, and the same is true for the hydrogen on the right-hand side. So next slide shows you this even in a little bit more detail. So you see the relative abundance of these water group ions in comparison to the other ions, and you immediately see that here as a function of time, but you see where we are in the magnetosphere because of these lines. The lines are, again, the orbits of the moons. You immediately see that the Enceladus, which is the E here, shows a dramatically different distribution of these water group ions compared to the rest of the magnetosphere. And from right to left, you go radially outward. So you see that the amount of water and also the amount of OH+, especially, is increasing as a function of radial distance from the planet. And, of course, this is all these processes which take place here between Enceladus and, let's say, Dione are responsible for that relative abundances. So this is also totally new and has never been measured before Cassini. So if you go to the next slide, you see that, of course, all this material comes out of those tiger stripes. I think we can go on to the next slide right away, where, again, you see where this material is coming from, and I think you are all familiar with it, so maybe we can skip that slide and continue on to the next one, because this shows how an artist looks at the magnetosphere of Saturn by knowing that there is Enceladus as a major source with a plume in the southern hemisphere, creating a cloud of material, creating the entire E-ring, because there's also a dust, of course, coming out of the system, and also filling up the entire magnetosphere with this material coming out from that little moon. So on the next slide, I would like to talk about the magnetosphere itself. And one of the questions we always wanted to know is Saturn's magnetosphere more like the magnetosphere of the Earth, or is it more like the magnetosphere of Jupiter? There are major differences, but there are also a lot of things which are the same in all three magnetospheres. So one of the things which we know from Earth is that around the Earth, there is a different a current system or a few current systems around the magnetosphere, and one of them is the so-called ring current. And the ring current is nothing else than drifting material around the planet due to those one of those invariants I was talking about in the beginning of the presentation. Electrons are moving one way around the planet, the different charge, the ions are moving the other way around, and of course if you separate charges, this is nothing else than a current in same as in your light bulb. And so you will see that there is a motion of particles all the way around the planet, and this is here imaged for the very first time as emissions seen in what we call ENAs. ENAs is nothing else than energetic neutral atoms, and they are created by collisions or by charge exchange processes between charged particles and cold neutrals, creating hot neutrals and cold ions. And what you see here is the emission of these hot neutrals, which are created in this process. And we were only able to see that from far away from Saturn itself at high latitudes, because this is the equatorial plane, which you see there. You see Rhea's orbit as one of the dashed lines close to Saturn, and you see Titan's orbit. And therefore, you see immediately that the emission itself, the red one, which is the highest emission, is somewhere in between these two orbits. So in a distance between, let's say, 8 and 15 planetary radii away from the planet, this is where we see this ring current. So it's the first image of a ring current of Saturn, which we were able to see with Cassini. If you go on to the next slide, this ring current is also important in getting more experience and getting more knowledge about all these plasma processes. And one of those parameters where we are behind in the magnetospheric community is what we call the plasma beta, which is the particle pressure versus the magnetic pressure. If the plasma beta is bigger than one, then the particles play the more important role, and if it's less than one, then the magnetic field plays the most important aspect in a magnetosphere. And with Cassini now, by having more than 120 orbits now, we were able to see how these plasma beta is evolving as a function of distance from the planet in the magnetosphere of Saturn. And you see here in the lower panel this plasma beta plotted as a function of radial distance. And you immediately see that in a region between, let's say, between 9 and 18, this line on average is above 1. So this is 10 to the 0. This is the 1. So the particle pressure and also the plasma beta plays the more important role in the magnetosphere than the magnetic field. And this was not really known before. This is the real measurement. And therefore, all the processes which you deal with are different in nature as in further in or further out in the magnetosphere, where the magnetic field plays a more important role. So if you go to the next slide, if you look at the shape of this plasma disk, which I was mentioning before, this plasma disk is the amount of particles essentially very much along the equatorial plane of Saturn, is also evolving as a function of location of Saturn relative to the incident angle of the solar wind. And therefore, this lower panel shows the three extremes, essentially. So the one on the left shows the field lines during the first part, the nominal mission phase of Saturn, because the southern hemisphere was more illuminated than the northern part. Then equinox is shown in the center plot, and then what we are running now in the solstice mission is shown on the right-hand side. So you see immediately that it highly depends where Saturn is located relative to the incoming solar wind, and therefore in the first phase, in the nominal mission, the entire magnetosphere was shaped like a bowl, and this is shown in the upper part of this light, that the entire magnetosphere was somehow shaped like a bowl. So this means that the entire magnetosphere and this plasma sheet was bent upward relative to the equatorial plane where all the moons, of course, are essentially located. So this gives us a totally different view as in the, let's say, in the during the Equinox mission, where this plasma sheet was really in the center, also along the equatorial plane, and therefore the interaction between the moons and the magnetospheres and the magnetosphere of Saturn was, of course, totally different because more particles hit the moon during the Equinox mission than in the nominal mission, and this plays a very important role by analyzing the data. In the next slide, or in the next further slide, you see that, of course, when we measure all these the what we call the plasma moments of the particles, we can also determine how fast the entire magnetosphere and the particles are flowing around the planet. And this is shown in that slide, where you see on the left, you see arrows here in the equatorial, projected into the equatorial plane, and the length of the arrows gives you the velocity of itself, while the direction gives you the motion of these slides in the of these particles in the equatorial plane. So you immediately see that nearly all of the material is co-rotating with the planet at a various speed. And if you plot the speed relative to the motion of the magnetosphere itself, as it should be, if it's rigidly co-rotating with the planet itself, you you would see that that is not fully co-rotation all over the magnetosphere, and this is shown on the right-hand side of that slide. So you see here the dashed red line, this is the amount of velocity you would see if all the particles would be essentially co-rotating fully with the planet. But you see that the blue and the black symbols here show that they are somehow diverting from that red line, and this is also very important in understanding some of the processes far down into the magnetotail of Saturn's magnetosphere. And this is also for the very first time where we were able to determine all of these parameters in very much detail. If you go on into the next slide, I'm starting now the discussion about the dynamics of the magnetosphere of Saturn, which is one of the most exciting topics we were working on. And just to give you an insight of what, for example, we have seen at Saturn is shown here, we call this interchange and injection events. And this is nothing else than a mixing of all these particle populations between outer parts and inner parts, where hot plasma is injected into cold plasma, and this cold plasma is then again drifting around the planet, creating these signatures which you see here on the left. So again, you see here energy as a function of time or as a function of distance from the planet, and you see that all these yellow and red lines here, they are somehow bent, and this is what we call a time dispersive character of our energy spectrograms. And from which you can determine where these particles have been injected and how much of those particles have been injected and how old they are and how long they are already rotating in the magnetosphere. And this is very important to understand the entire physics which is happening in the magnetosphere. So if you go on to the next slide, you see if you study all of those injection events and make a sort of a histogram where they are happening mostly in the magnetosphere, you see by a study which is shown on that slide that most of those particles are injected in the midnight sector of the magnetosphere. So this is way down in the tail, but essentially only in this night side. So you have more of those events between the local time region between 2100 and 3 o'clock than on the day side, which is 12 o'clock in that slide. So they are more abundant in the night sector, and this is also consistent with another set of data which we have, because we see that these brightenings, which I was showing you before in this ring current image, this brightening of these ENA emissions also happen in the night sector predominantly, and they start being seen in that direction. And of course, this has to do with these injections, because as I told you earlier, if there is a charged particle population hitting into a cold neutral population, these ENAs, these energetic neutrals, are created and emit then emitted and can be measured by Cassini, and this happens predominantly in the tail. So if you go onto the next slide, you see even further down the tail what we think is very important in a magnetospheric configuration, and this is the magnetotail dynamics. So since we know that Enceladus is creating a lot of material in the magnetosphere, 100 to 300 kilograms per second, we have to get rid of this material somehow. And one of the processes where people think is important in that sense is what we call a reconnection and a plasmoid release. And this is shown in that image, that you see field lines which are connected back to the magnetosphere and also connected to your source, which is Enceladus, is somehow mass-loaded. So you can think about a rubber band which is loaded with pearls and more pearls and more pearls, and then you rotate with your entire rubber band. So this rubber band is stretched, and if you put more pearls on that rubber band, at some point the rubber band breaks and the pearls fly down the tail. And this is exactly what these pearls is our particles, and this is enormous amount of material which is released down the tail. And this obviously happens periodically. At every rotation, more or less, one of those rubber bands is breaking off. The rubber bands are, of course, the magnetic field lines, so they snap back, and then the entire process starts again. And this has been already measured with Cassini on the next slide. If you continue on the next slide, there is a study by Jackman and others where you can really see that this is really happening. And these plasmoids are somehow observable if you look at the magnetic field. And there's a signature in the magnetic field where the direction of the magnetic field changes from being more from north to south to south to north or vice versa. So, and this is a very nice indicator of something happens in the magnetic field configuration from being radially stretched outward to being radially stretched inward and vice versa. And if this is somehow changing the orientation, you can be sure that you're on one or the other side of a plasmoid which has been released. And this has been found so far, I think, 24 times or 25 times in the magnetosphere of Saturn during that phases where we are in the right location with Cassini. But nevertheless, it should be visible more often and should be from the theory, from the theoretical point of view, we should see that nearly at every rotation of the planet. So this fits very nicely a very old but very still valid picture of Vasiliunas, which is shown on that slide, where this again shows the stretching and the release of a plasmoid of a magnetosphere, which is the same picture as we know from Jupiter. If we continue, then we'll talk in the next slide about the aurora and what we call the open-closed field line boundary of an aurora. And in the slide, in the upper next slide on the open-closed field line boundary from Gwinnett's paper, you see immediately what we are talking about. So encircled with this red circle, you see that by looking at the data along and away from the magnetic field, so at this pitch angle, which I was talking about before, of zero versus pitch angle of 180 degrees, which is the opposite direction of the magnetic field, you see that if you measure the amount of electrons along those two directions, that they differ by several orders of magnitude. So you immediately know that something has happened between being, the same amount along the field lines and then being not the same later on. And this, what we think, is exactly by crossing the boundary between a closed and an open field line. If you go on to the next slide, you see where we have found those locations in a model field of the Saturnian magnetosphere. And you see all these blue dots on that slide. They are all found at high latitudes where we think this is where the open and closed field line boundary can be traced down all the way to the aurora. And, of course, you can also do in the next slide by looking at all these events measured in the data from Cassini. You can map this and just project the entire number of data points onto images, real images from the UVS instrument of the aurora, and try to find out where you see these big differences in these fluxes along and away from the planet. And you immediately see that all these lines, which you see here on these few images from the aurora, that all these lines are essentially inside this main emission ring of the aurora from Saturn. And this is the theory behind this is simply that inside that main emission ring of Saturn, this is where only open field lines are connected on one side, but not on the other side of the hemisphere of Saturn, while directly at the boundary between this main emission and the more polar region, this is where we are still closed field lines. And so this is a very nice indication that we were now able, by having these high inclination orbits with Cassini, we were able to map out these open to closed field line boundary. And this is also very important to understand if the aurora is more Earth-like or more Jupiter-like. And at the moment, we think it's more Earth-like than Jupiter-like. If you go on to the next slide, we continue about a topic which is highly discussed at the moment, and this is rotational modulation and periodicities in the magnetosphere. On the next slide, you see what we are talking about. So originally, we thought from previous missions that we are able to really determine the rotation period of Saturn by just looking at the radio and plasma wave data, which is called here the SKR, the Saturn kilometric radiation, which is shown in the upper left corner as these stripes of frequency range versus signal strength, and the color indicates how much of those waves have been recorded at the spacecraft. And you see that they are appearing regularly. They're appearing regularly every 10 hours, 45 minutes, and 45 seconds. Originally, that was the idea. But then if you go on to the next slide, we found not only in this SKR, this Saturn kilometric radiation, we found this periodic variations, but also in a new set of nearly all the particles and fields instrumentations you see in the magnetic field, as well as in the plasma measurements, in the energetic neutrals. And we saw different periodicities by looking at different instrumentations. If you continue on the next slide, you see that in addition to that, there's not only that variation is stable and repeats every 10 hour 45 seconds, 45 minutes, it also changes. And you see here in the red and in the turquoise color that there are two major emissions appearing in the Cassini images, one in the north and one in the south. So this is a big debate at the moment where this is coming from. You can trace even this back to other spacecraft like Ulysses, and even further down to in time that there were two different components of emissions also present in the Voyager data. And this is all related to the location of Saturn relative to the Sun, which is plotted on the upper in the upper panel of that slide. So this is a big debate going on. Why is this? What is this causing? And what is really the rotation period of Saturn? This is not solved at the moment. So if you go on to the next slide, you see that there are several models out there. I will not go through all of this, but you see that there are explanations by looking at the core magnetic field, by these variations in the magnetosphere, as well as into the ionosphere, and all of those have pros and cons in explaining these periodicities in Saturn's magnetosphere. And this is something I think we will be staying on with until the end of the mission. But there are more and more converging into more consistent pictures which can explain more than just one or the other observations, but all of them at the same time. On the next slide, this is this movie I was talking about in the beginning. I will skip this. This is one of the explanations of these rotational modulation. And if you click on that movie after the telecon, maybe then you will see what this is all about. It shows you how the magnetosphere is reacting, how this ANA emission is lighting up, and how the Saturn kilometric radiation is lighting up as well at the same time. So this gives you a sort of an explanation from a model point of view how you can explain some of the rotational modulation. On the next slide, and this is the final section of my presentation, I will show you a few slides about the interaction of this magnetospheric plasma with the rings and the moons. So on the first slide. I think we can skip this. You have seen this in Amanda's presentation. I will concentrate in my few slides about this on Enceladus, a little bit about Rhea, and about this earring. This earring is this faint ring which is not really visible at all times, created by Enceladus, by this dust and water molecules which are coming out of the system. On the next slide, I have to give you a short introduction of what we look at when we look at these moon-magnetosphere interactions from the particle's point of view. So there are a couple of different interactions which you see in different parameters of our instruments. One of it is, for example, the sputtering of surface material. And this is simply when one of those particles along the field lines bouncing back and forth along the field lines hit the surface, there is some material of the surface sputtered off the surface and can be measured close to the moon itself or even further away from the magnetosphere. And a second interaction parameter is when you look at the direction of the magnetic field, because all these moving field lines in the magnetosphere, when they enter an obstacle like a moon, they cannot simply penetrate through that object, but they are somehow see this as a sort of an obstacle in their way. So they are somehow diverted around that object and even pushed together slightly. And the particles itself, they have to flow around that object, which is shown in the right lower corner. So by measuring all these parameters, like the magnetic field strength and the direction, as well as the plasma flow velocity and direction, you can already say a lot about how the magnetospheric plasma and the moon are interacting with each other. If you continue on the next slide, a third very nice tool to investigate this moon-magnetosphere interaction is what we call an ion pickup process. This is nothing else than if a neutral is rotating around a magnetosphere and is ionized for some specific process, they see directly when they are charged, they see the magnetic field as well as the electric field inside the magnetosphere, and they have to follow what we call a cycloid motion in this pickup process. And of course, they are accelerated along their path along that cycloidic motion. And of course, when you fly by very close to a moon where these processes happen, then you can determine the velocity and also the species type, because the cycloid itself, the length of this cycloid, or the diameter of the cycloid gives you the gyro radius, and this, of course, translates into velocity and mass. So if you go to the next slide, this is one of those discoveries which Cassini made recently by looking at these pickup ion processes close to the moon Rhea. And this illustration shows you that by flying by very close to Cassini, you see that this white line, this is the trajectory of Cassini on the Rhea flyby in 2005, the Rhea number one flyby, that they have been measurements of different types of ions which are picked up in this process I was explaining to you, very close to the planet on the two different sides, the charged, the negative and the positive pickup ions are seen at different locations. And this this insert on the right upper part shows you the amount of these particles relative to the location where they have been found, from which you can determine if this is the case, then Rhea has to have a sort of an exosphere where these particles are coming from. So when there's a charged particle hitting the atmosphere where the neutral CO2 and O2 molecules are present, they got picked up, they got charged, and they are then able to escape from those atmospheres and are able to be measured by a fly-bying spacecraft. So this is a very nice tool to investigate atmospheres or exospheres and surroundings of a moon by looking at particles and fields instrumentation very close to the moon. On the next slide, now we go into the process of particles hitting the moon directly. And this simply should illustrate you that if there's a particle along the field lines hitting the moon, they are lost. And they leave this gap I was talking about in the beginning, along their way around the moon. But in addition to that, they are also drifting along, you know, inside this continuously stream of particles co-rotating with the planet itself. And there is a one energy where the motion of the particles itself is exactly the same as the moon, and they are not seeing the moon essentially by bouncing back and forth and drifting around the planet around the moon itself. So if you are what we call this resonant energy, if you have ions which are lower than this resonant energy, they are flying into this co-rotational flow, and they if they are higher in energy, then they go into the other direction because the moon is slightly faster than the combined drift motions of those ions. So by looking at various electrons and ions at various energies, you can determine how the interaction took place and how important this interaction is in explaining the environment of the moon itself. So if you go to the next slide, this is actually how we found this plume of Enceladus, by looking at the material of particles released from that moon, and by the diversion of the magnetic field, and by looking at the particle composition and all these drift motions around this little moon. And the result is shown in that slide, that a normally very symmetric magnetic field, which is pointing in the north-south direction close to the moon, is bent because of this material coming out of the moon, and therefore it has been discovered by the particle fields that there is an activity on Enceladus. And later on, the camera and the other remote sensing instruments, they looked, of course, into that direction and found the plumes and all this material coming out of these jets of the Tiger stripes. But it was a discovery from the MAC team. On the next slide, this is one of our latest discoveries, and this was mentioned by Amanda in the beginning as well, that we are now able to also not only look at the plume itself, but also its connection all the way along one of the field lines connecting the moon with the aurora. And this material, which is flying along that field line from the moon all the way to the aurora, creates a specific emission, what we call this Enceladus footprint, seen on the right-hand side in the UVS data. And this is already known from Jupiter very nicely, from all the four Galilean satellites, essentially from the three out of the four Galilean satellites, we see these footprints. But it is the first time that we see this also for Enceladus. And it's only there once in a while. I think this is not yet clear why this is not shown all the time. And therefore, it's very important to know how specific this particular time period was in terms of the dynamics and in terms of the magnetosphere itself. And therefore, I think it's very new and very nice to see that there's also a footprint there, and that the theory at least holds also the observation very nicely. So there's a lot of investigation going on at the moment, and there's also new theories being developed to really explain why this is not there all the time. On the next slide, I will only briefly say something about recent CDA measurements. I think Sibi is going to talk about this also as well. So there has been this discovery of more sodium-rich ice grains coming out of the vents, which point in the two direction that there is a liquid water interior very inside of the moon itself. If this points into a liquid ocean or just a pocket of water, I think it's not yet clear, but essentially it shows that there must be a reservoir of liquid water inside the moon, creating all these vents and all this blue material coming out from the southern part of the magnetosphere. So this is another highlight of MAPS instrumentation, recently published by Postberg in a Nature paper. On the next slide, and this is one of my final slides already, I will talk briefly about very nice results of our investigation of the particle instrumentation. Recently, we were able to find out that by looking at these energy spectrograms close to the moons, to the inner moons of Saturn, that they have features, they leave features in the energy distributions which we can really look at in more detail and can determine magnetospheric parameters, but also a lot of parameters which are necessary to enhance the model output of how a magnetosphere looks like. And this is one example of this. So in addition to what I described as macrosignatures, we see microsignatures. And these microsignatures is nothing else than really locally the gap in the distribution if you pass by a moon very nicely along their orbital trajectories. And they leave out these kind of gaps in the distribution. So you can look, if you look into the next slide, you can look at all of those moons, and you know where the moons are orbiting, and suddenly you see another absorption signature like the one where you think this could only come from a moon. But nevertheless, there's not only moons which create this absorption, it's all kinds of material which are absorbing material, those particles which are bouncing back and forth along the field lines. When there's material in their way, in their bounce motion, they are lost. And one of the nice results early in the mission was simply that we found such a signature in our data where there is no moon, but we knew that there is what we call the G-ring arc. And the G-ring arc is nothing else than an enhancement of material along the G-ring, which is much more dense than the rest of the G-ring. And it happens that Cassini just flew through that ring arc at one of those orbits, and we saw this distribution, this dropout signature, and we could determine how much material was in this arc, which is not measured directly from the imaging results. But the combination of the two clearly showed that there was this arc. We could determine where it is along the orbit and how much material we really have in the arc compared to the rest of the G-ring. So this is one of the nice tools to look at absorption signatures, or what we call microsignatures, at the moons, also for other objects, and we can find new moons or moonlets or new arcs or anything else which is creating these type of absorbing signals in our data. If we go into the next, we can go even further, and we can say, okay, we know where we should be observing this microsignature because we know the orbit of the moons, we know the orbit of the arcs now. So if there is some displacements in time where we see these positions of these microsignatures, we can determine and we can find out the reasons why these microsignatures are somehow displaced, and from which we can determine, if inefficiencies in magnetic field models or unidentified magnetospheric electric fields. So on the next slide, you see it's not as easy as this. So normally you would see organized versus complex signatures. So the one on the upper one on the left is a normal organized signature, but you see the two lower panels show that they are much more complicated. But of course also the complicated ones, the complex ones can tell us something because they are created by the same moon or by the same object, but we simply observe them multiple times, more than once. So the entire magnetosphere obviously is dynamic, and this bite-out caused by the moon itself is passing by the spacecraft multiple times, which tells us a lot about the displacements, which are something which is nothing else than the dynamics of the magnetosphere itself. If you click one further down, you see that, again, we can determine this displacement origin by assuming two different types of origin, and we favor at the moment that this electric field is something which we account for these displacements and from which we can determine the dynamics quite nicely of the magnetosphere. And the next slide is already the summary. So I hope that I showed you that with particle fields we can also do imaging. We can make a picture from the magnetosphere, which is normally not visible with other instrumentation. And we found that Enceladus plays a major role in the magnetosphere. Actually, it's the same role as the moon Io does for Jupiter's magnetosphere. Titan, we found out that is not playing a major role, at least not for the magnetosphere, but of course, locally, it's a very important object. And of course, the interaction between the magnetosphere and Titan's atmosphere is very important. But for the magnetosphere itself, it is not a major source of particles. We found also that transport mechanisms are very important to understand the magnetosphere. The parameters from the rotation is, it's not yet clear what the rotation of Saturn really is by looking at all these parameters from the various instrumentations. And, of course, the interaction with the icy moons between these magnetospheric particles and the icy moons play a very important role to understand not only the magnetosphere but also the moons itself. I've shown you that, for example, one of the findings is that Rhea has an atmosphere and that Enceladus has a liquid ocean. So if you summarize all of this in a slide, which is my final slide, this is the new image of Saturn's magnetosphere as derived from some of the early observations. So we think that we can determine what we call a ring current, which is this reddish part in the center. Then there's, of course, Titan and all the other moons in the magnetosphere. There's a lot of dynamics going on. It's a large entity in space. And if you click on the final slide, then if you want to find out more, please check this book, which is very interesting, and there's a lot of details in there, and watch for new results which are coming up in the next few years. Thank you very much. I hope that I was a little not too long and you got the image.
That was great, Norbert. That was great. Thank you very much. You really did cover a lot of material. Do we have questions for Norbert about the magnetosphere? I was I really liked your slides 43 and 48 that summarized what we know about the rotational modulation and some of the theories. I thought those are really nice. I guess those were put together at the recent Magnetospheres of the Outer Planets meeting. Is that right?
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
So we had this Magnetospheres of the Outer Planets conference, which happened every 2 years, and this summary was done by Laurent Lamy. He gave a very nice summary of all these models and all the observations from the periodicities.
Yeah, I mean, it's clearly still just the biggest mystery, I think, about Saturn that we have. Are there any other brief questions for Norbert? I know it's late in Germany, and we've got two more speakers, but if there are any questions? I don't hear any. So thank you very much, Norbert. That was really very comprehensive, really, really good. Okay, so I hope we have our next speaker online. Andy, are you there?
Yes, you do.
Oh, good. Okay, so our next speaker is Dr. Andy Ingersoll, and he's a professor of planetary science from Caltech, and he's on the he has a long list of credentials, but he's on the Cassini imaging team, and he's also the Cassini interdisciplinary scientist for the Saturn discipline, and that's what he's going to tell us about today. And hopefully everyone has downloaded his presentation, and it's called Something Obvious. Does everyone have that? Anybody have problems getting it? Okay, so Andy, I'll hand it over to you.
All right. This, if you're looking at slide one, you'll see at the very top, it says equinox. And that's because most of my slides, or two-thirds of them, are really a presentation I gave at NASA headquarters to summarize what we had learned from the equinox mission. Now, the actual equinox, when the sun went through the equatorial plane of Saturn, was in August of 2009. And there was a lot of very interesting things when that happened. The rings almost disappeared from our view, and it became suddenly very dark on the night side, and because the rings were no longer illuminating the night side, and we were able to see lightning. And so part of my talk is about summary of what happened over the equinox period, and then the rest is to march on to the solstice mission, which is what we're in now, and that's going to go until 2017, when it'll be northern summer solstice on Saturn. So the second slide, slide number two, there's a little number in the lower right corner, sort of is my summary. And I don't want to read all this stuff, but there's really three kinds of things, mission objectives, things we're trying to accomplish. One was to make up for, let's not call them mistakes, but disappointments, where Saturn threw us a curveball. Saturn made it harder to measure something than we thought it would. Measuring the rotation of the planet turned out to be harder than we expected, because then the reason, as you heard, is that Saturn's magnetic field is aligned perfectly with, almost perfectly, we hope, but it, so far it looks perfect, alignment with the rotation. So there's nothing to wobble, as there is for every other planet which has a magnetic field. There's, since the alignment is perfect, we just see a constant magnetic field rotating with the planet, but we don't see a wobbling magnetic field, which would tell us the internal rotation rate. I'll explain how we're going to hopefully measure subtle misalignments during the end of the solstice mission. Another thing we want to do in the solstice mission is to watch the seasons change, because we're going from spring in the north to summer in the north, and the weather on Saturn is going to change as a result of those seasonal changes. And finally, there are new discoveries, things that we didn't expect. In the lower left corner is the famous hexagon on Saturn, and Voyager discovered the hexagon in 1980, and we were just infinitely pleased and surprised to see it was still there after all these years. And on the lower right corner of slide 2, you'll see a little storm, which turned out to be one of the lightning storms in the southern hemisphere. Now we have a huge, much bigger storm raging in the northern hemisphere, and I'll tell you about that. So, moving on to slide 3, is just a picture of, on the left, is what Cassini measured for the different components of the magnetic field. You can see that they are absolutely symmetric. This was time along the lower axis there as the spacecraft went past Saturn in 2004, very close to Saturn. And if this field had been tilted, we would have seen an asymmetry between the left side and the right side, and you can't see any there. On the right, we see the orbit tracks that are planned for 2017, when the spacecraft will be coming in over one pole and skimming along the equator and then going out along the other pole. And we get many such orbital paths, and because we're so close to the planet during these orbits, we expect that if there's any irregularity in the internal field of the planet, the dynamo field that's coming from Saturn's interior, we will see it, and we'll measure the wobble, and that'll tell us how fast Saturn is rotating on the inside. Next is another fundamental quantity, which has proved harder than we thought to measure, is the hydrogen to helium ratio, or helium to hydrogen ratio. This is slide number 4. These giant planets, in their composition, they resemble the Sun, but there are subtle differences, and these differences are very important for understanding how the planets were put together and how they've evolved and whether there's been any separation between the different components. And so we want to measure the helium to hydrogen ratio in the atmosphere so we can compare it with the helium to hydrogen ratio on the Sun, and also so we can understand the bulk density of Saturn. And it's turned out to be a tough job, because the way we do it is we can measure the density, which is proportional temperature divided by the molecular weight. We can measure the density of the atmosphere from the bending of rays that pass tangentially through the atmosphere. So that gives us T over M. And then from the infrared observations, we measure T itself, just temperature. And if you know both those quantities, you can solve for M, which is the molecular weight, and that's how we get helium to hydrogen ratio. And that's turned out to be harder because ray bending is a more complicated thing on Saturn because it's not a sphere and it's the precise geometry is affected by the winds and the rotation, and a lot of that is uncertain. But we have a plan, and we're going to execute it during the solstice mission. Next, this was a pleasant surprise, number five. We discovered that we knew all along that we were capable of looking at Saturn with radio waves. So these are 2-centimeter wavelength radio waves. But what we didn't realize in going in was how detailed and rich these images would be. You have to be very close to actually image the planet with radio waves, but these are a sample of the kind of radio images we've been taking, and it allows us to see deeper into the atmosphere than we can see with our ordinary images, because the clouds and the haze and the smog and the atmosphere sort of limits our ability to see deep. But these radio waves allow us to see deeper. And there's a lot going on, and we're trying to sort it out. Actually, you can see sort of a special, right in the middle band here is the, it's sort of brighter in that middle band, and that's plus or minus 10 degrees of latitude. It's sort of comparable to the Earth's tropics, the subtropics of Earth. So there's the Sahara Desert over on the right, that very bright region, except, of course, it isn't a desert at all. It's a fluid planet. But for meteorologists, it's very interesting to study the differences between planets. And so there is this sort of similarity between the tropics and subtropics on giant planets and that on Earth. The same theme now, slide 6. Also peering deeper than the regular clouds, at 5 microns, which is infrared wavelengths, we can also see deeper. And there's a huge structure in the atmosphere down at several bars pressure, 1 bar being the typical level of the clouds that we see with the camera. And now here we're seeing 2 or 3 bars in the infrared, and there's a lot going on down there, as you can see in slide 6. Another topic, slide 7, is the winds. The giant planet winds, this is velocity along the lower axis and then latitude along the upper axis. First of all, the winds blow much faster than they do on Earth, maybe 10 times faster on Saturn than they do on Earth. The jet streams, which we think are a pretty big deal, they blow at 100 miles an hour. Well, here we're talking at maybe 1,000 miles an hour speed. Although they seem to vary, at least at the equator, the winds on Saturn are variable, and we're trying to see if that's a seasonal effect or whether maybe it's an altitude effect, that some years we see deeper than other years and we see different speed for the winds. And we're sorting that out, and obviously to see seasonal changes on a planet which has it's a year, 30 years long, you need to be patient. And that's what the solstice mission is going to give us, is the full seasonal coverage. Slide 8 also shows us seasonal change. This is still in the before the equinox. This was back in 2000. This image here was back in 2008, I believe. And you can see the difference between the two hemispheres. The southern hemisphere, which was in late summer at this time, was covered by haze and smog, and you couldn't see the cloud details very well. And the northern hemisphere was much clearer, allowing you to see deeper and see all this detail. And as we've watched seasons change and the shadow that you see, that's the shadow of the rings up in the northern hemisphere, that is now down in the southern hemisphere because the sun is above the equator now. The northern hemisphere, now that it's getting full-blown sunlight, is turning hazy and smoggy under the rays of the sun, and the southern hemisphere is clearing up. So that's another Earth analogy. Saturn has smog. Okay, slide 9 shows you this rediscovered hexagon after 30 years of waiting. It was still there. The latitude of the hexagon is about 75 degrees north latitude. And you can see, if you look carefully at this little three-step movie, you'll see that the corners of the hexagon are not changing their position, but the individual, small individual clouds are moving in a counterclockwise direction around the hexagon. So what is this hexagon? It is a current in the atmosphere going in a counterclockwise direction, and all the little small spots are traveling with the current, but the pattern of the current is stationary, so that you could say that it's an eastward current with waves that are stationary, and we are beginning to understand this, and it has analogs with the meandering current in the Gulf Stream of the oceans and the meandering jet streams on Earth. But for some reason, this is a much more stable and permanent type current with almost stationary meander patterns. Okay, now let's move on to slide 10. We've been watching the auroras on Saturn. I call them auroras because there's one in the north, one in the south, and we also measure them in different ways, in the ultraviolet on the left and then in the infrared on the right, because all those electrically charged particles coming in from outside the atmosphere heat up the atmosphere and cause it to glow both in the ultraviolet and also from the heating, it glows in the infrared as well. But moving on, we have actually got some movies now of the aurora, and if someone, whoever is controlling the slides from your end, would start this movie, you'll see stars going by. Of course, the stars aren't really moving. It's the spacecraft that's moving. And you can see this sort of yellowish curtain that goes flashing by. This is a 80-hour movie. And you can... Whoa, we got a sudden brightening here on my screen. And you can... Let's play that movie again, please. You can see this movie. And we're beginning to connect phenomena like this, which are the aurora, the glowing atmosphere, with phenomena out in the magnetosphere that Norbert was telling you about. And exactly how these charged particles coming in and how deep they go is all contained in a movie like this. Well, that's one of the dark side phenomena that we have been observing on the dark side of the planet. The other dark side phenomenon that we've been very interested in is lightning. And go to slide number 12, you can see the problem with measuring the dark side of Saturn. This picture was taken with the sun directly behind Saturn. So what you're looking at is the dark side of Saturn, but it's not entirely dark, and that's because the rings shine down on the dark side, causing it to be brighter than Earth under a full moon. You can also see the sun peeping around the horizon, and you can see the clouds lit up all the way around the horizon in this sort of white ring. But during the equinox in August of 2009, and actually for several months after, because the rings were edge-on to the sun, they were much less bright, and we were able to see the lightning finally. Here's the next slide, slide 13, a little nine-panel view of a little spot, a little cloud, but in some of the panels, there's a white dot, or even two white dots, and those are the lightning flashes. The camera shutter was open for 2 minutes, which is quite a long time, and there was just enough ring shine on the dark side to illuminate this little white cloud, but not enough to cause it to be to saturate the camera and overexpose it. So we were able to see the cloud and at the same time see the lightning dots in the cloud. I like the one at the bottom center, which has two lightning flashes, and actually over on the right bottom has two lightning flashes. Well, these are southern hemisphere lightning storms, and I'll tell you shortly about the really big guy in the northern hemisphere. But next, let me show you a little silly movie we put together. Since the radio receiver on the Cassini spacecraft can hear the electrical spark-like signals, it's a radio signal, sort of like static electricity. They're listening to lightning all the time, and the camera is photographing the lightning. And we put them together in this little movie, which someone will play, and it's got sound. We invented, so those are the sounds of lightning. Actually, it's a synthetic sound because the real sounds on the radio receiver are above the frequency of the human ear, so you can't really hear it directly. We certainly can detect the lightning in these two ways. One is to see it with the camera, and the other is to hear it with the radio. From the size of the flashes, moving on to slide 15, from the size of the flashes, we can tell that we're not seeing the lightning directly. We're seeing it lighting up the clouds above. And we have some idea of how high the clouds above are. They're the ammonia cloud. And the deeper the lightning is, the bigger the area that it will light up. Because the light sort of diffuses upward and spreads out as it moves upward. So from the diameter of the lightning flashes, when it finally illuminates the top clouds, we can tell how deep the lightning is, and that little bracket on the right, on slide 15, shows the depth. And on the left is a model of the different cloud layers on Saturn. And interestingly enough, the lightning turns out to be at about the same level as lightning is on Earth, which is sort of the boundary between ice clouds and liquid water clouds. It's at about that point. And the mechanism for producing the electrical charge is probably the same, the interaction between falling ice particles and more slowly falling liquid water drops. Okay, now my last topic, which is on slide 16, is the giant storm on Saturn. What happened here is that on Saturn was its usual bland self going into the end of the year in 2010. And then on December 5th, a little spot appeared in the northern hemisphere, and it grew to this giant storm. And on this in this figure with on the cover of Nature magazine, you can see the head of the storm. We call it the nose, I guess, which is sort of pointing off to the left, and then the tail trails out to the right and goes all the way around the planet and comes back in from the left to somewhat slightly displaced to the south of the nose. And so this is a picture actually from February when the disturbance from the storm had wrapped around the planet. It's also a copious producer of lightning, as evidenced by the radio noise that it's producing. So this was our objective during the Equinox mission, and it was to increase the coverage of the northern hemisphere as it emerges from behind the rings. And we did not expect we would see one of these giant storms. The giant storms have been observed before, and they occur once every 20 or 30 years. So this tells us about the weather on Saturn. It's very intermittent. It stores up its energy for 20 or 30 years and then lets it go all at once. A great puzzle to meteorologists why the weather should be so different, unlike the weather on Jupiter and Earth. Let's move on to slide 18. This is sort of the history in December. On December 13th, an amateur astronomer took this picture, A. December 22nd, amateur took it, B. And then the Cassini took this picture, C, on December 24th. So this storm started at one point, and on the same day that it was first seen by the camera, and from Earth by the Cassini camera, that same day is when the eruption of radio noise came on. The next slide shows the radio signals. This is different days, and basically there's one storm at one longitude on the planet, and as the planet rotates, you get an episode of radio noise for half the rotation of the planet. Then the storm goes beyond the horizon, and you get silence, and then you get another episode, and they keep coming like this. This is all during December, all these episodes as the storm rotated into the field of view and then out of the field of view. Here's one such episode on slide 20. The lightning must have been flashing faster than 10 flashes per second from this storm, because it saturated the radio receiver. That's the red, the big, huge red curve. This is a six-hour period along the lower axis. You can see all the... this is when the storm was in the field of view of the Cassini camera, and it just totally saturated the receiver. Also, each individual flash is 10 or 100 times more powerful a radio emitter than the... lightning flashes on Earth. So that, too, is amazing that Saturn should store up so much energy. Now, the camera took some really beautiful detailed pictures, slide 21, of this storm. If you look carefully on the lower left of A, you'll see clouds on top of clouds crisscrossing each other. The different colors in this case represent different cloud heights. And you can see this big yellow blob at the nose of the storm. That represents high, thick clouds, sort of like thunderheads. And that is where the lightning is being emitted. The lower parts, C and D, are two mosaics, not a single image, but mosaics of the storm 11 hours apart. And you can see subtle differences in those two images because the clouds are moving, after all. And we're pulling wind measurements out of that right now as we speak. And slide 22 shows the temperatures associated with this giant storm. The horizontal axis is latitude, sort of across from north of the storm on the left, south of the storm on the right. And actually the storm produced big temperature changes in the stratosphere, and right where the storm is that big blue blob. It's actually colder, and on either side, to the north and the south, it's warmer by up to 5 degrees Celsius. So we're still trying to figure this out, but the goal here is to compare the weather on Saturn with the weather on other planets, including the Earth. And that is my last slide.
That's great, Andy. Thank you very much. Do we have questions out there for Andy on Saturn and its atmosphere? Surely we must have a question out there.
Maybe there's nobody out there.
That could be. This is a long telecon.
Hello. This is Ron Hobbs from Seattle. I have a question.
Go ahead. Sure. Thank you.
How do you determine the longitude on Saturn?
It's an entirely arbitrary thing. There is no solid planet, so you don't have a zero meridian, a Greenwich, England, or anything like that. You just pick a constant rotation rate, and you just say, okay, at a certain instant of time, that longitude was crossing some celestial point in the galaxy or pointing toward a given star out there, and that is longitude zero. The rotation rate itself that we use was based on some Voyager observations that Norbert told you about, but we're not sure that it's really the interior of Saturn's rotation. It's close, but could differ by a significant amount.
Okay, thank you.
Welcome.
So you talked about, at the beginning of your talk, measuring subtle misalignments during the solstice mission to sort of give us some insight into the rotation rate or the internal structure. Were you referring to the magnetic field measurements, or are there additional measurements that we're going to make?
Well, we're going to measure gravity exquisitely and the magnetic field exquisitely, but the one that gives us the best hope of measuring the interior rotation is to measure the dynamo field, not the field that's out in the magnetosphere, because that's affected by all sorts of things, satellites and solar wind and everything else. And but the interior field that is generated on the inside of the planet, if we're very close to the planet and if there is some kind of misalignment, we ought to see it.
Okay, great. We probably ought to move along unless there's any final questions for Andy. We've got one more speaker, and we're running quite late. So thank you very much, Andy.
You're welcome.
Okay, hopefully we still have Zibi out there. Are you there, Zibi?
Yep, I'm here.
Okay. So our next speaker is Dr. Elizabeth Zibi Turtle. She's a planetary scientist at the Johns Hopkins University Applied Physics Lab in Laurel, Maryland. And Zibi's an associate of the imaging and the radar teams on Cassini, and she's going to highlight Titan and the icy satellite observations for us. Go ahead, Zibi.
Thanks. Let's see. I'm going to start with Titan, so we can actually go ahead a few slides. The third slide is the same overview of the entire Cassini-Huygens mission that Amanda showed. So being in the seventh year, we have seven Titan flybys, because that worked out nicely. A few less than some of the previous years, so they're a little more spaced out. The flyby dates themselves for Titan are listed on slide four, and I'll just move on to some of the results that we've had this year. The fifth slide shows our map of Titan. This is built up with ISS images. We have mostly complete coverage, actually, of Titan at this point, but it hasn't all been fit into the map. It's quite challenging because of the Titan's atmosphere makes it very difficult to observe the surface clearly, and you can see the seams in the map. That's just because it's quite difficult to get the brightnesses balanced with the differences in the observing geometry through the atmosphere. But what really stands out when you look at a map of Titan is that there's a lot of dark material at the equator, and there's a lot of dark material at the poles, and kind of blander surface in between. And what we found, of course, is that the dark areas at the equator are primarily dunes, these huge seas of dunes, and that at the poles, we actually have surface liquids in lakes and at the North Pole, some very large seas. So there's a wide variety of distributions of materials and terrains on Titan. And, of course, one of the things we've as we've discussed about the extended missions for Cassini, one of the high priorities is to understand how the seasons are changing and how that affects the different bodies in the Saturnian system. And Titan is no different. The sixth slide shows some observations from this past fall where we think we've seen a low latitude, a shift in the cloud activity, so the weather patterns, as the seasons change. The when Cassini arrived, I like to kind of put the mission into the Titanian year, if you will. So when Cassini arrived, it was kind of the equivalent of January 12th. It was kind of late southern summer. And we had the northern vernal equinox, as Andy was talking about, the ring plane crossing in August of 2009. Today is actually roughly the equivalent of April 15th, so maybe all the Titanians are busy filing their taxes. So we've moved, you know, about a quarter of a year, a Titanian year, in the time that Cassini has been observing Titan. When we first got there, we saw a lot of storms in the southern hemisphere, large convective systems over the South Pole, actually. And those have kind of died down. And now, all of a sudden, this fall, we wondered if we'd see shifts in the weather, of course, as the illumination from the sun shifts from the southern hemisphere to the northern hemisphere. Suddenly, this fall, we caught a couple of, a very large cloud outburst. You can see on the edge of the disk on the 27th of September, this large cloud, which is actually shaped like an arrow. It's fairly interesting. And that presumably evolved into the distribution of this band of clouds along the equator that we saw about a month later, almost a month later. So what we think we're seeing, or what we think we saw last fall, is evidence that there's a shift in the weather patterns. And this may be similar to what happens on Earth, except on a different scale. The seventh slide kind of shows on the left panel Titan's atmosphere and on the right panel Earth's atmosphere. On Earth, there's something called the intertropical convergence zone, and this kind of goes back and forth around the equator, and you get all the tropical storms. They shift back and forth from north to south, with the as the illumination changes. As you get more illumination in the north, it shifts to the north, and then back again to the south. But in Titan, on Titan, the atmospheric circulation is actually pole to pole, and so in the so what we originally had when Cassini got there was more like the top part labeled A, where we had clouds and storms at the South Pole in the southern summer. And what we think is happening is that shifting across the equator. And that as we get into northern, later northern spring and northern summer, we'll start to get large convective cloud systems at the North Pole. So far, we've only seen the one large. It may be that that's all we see, and then in a another year or two, clouds pop up in the northern hemisphere or higher northern latitudes. We're waiting to see how this evolves. Just to understand how the atmosphere works on Titan. So it'll be very interesting to see if we get more storms or if you get kind of one a year, one a Titanian year, and then it passes the weather systems pass through to the next hemisphere. In the wake of this storm, on slide 8, we show a sequence of observations. So the first panel shows kind of a big view. You can see that arrow cloud in the one labeled A. This is quite unusual for clouds as we generally understand them. It may be quite normal for clouds on Titan. There's ongoing research studying that. The area labeled Belette is one of these large dune fields. And if you kind of watch, look across the panel there, you see that this area that's outlined in blue in panel D changed. It got very dark. And that occurred over the space of about a month between the observation on 27th of September and the observation on 29th of October. We have some observations since then as well, which show that that darkening has brightened again. The one in the top group of images labeled E and labeled H on the bottom group, it just zoomed in a little more on the bottom group, and the arrows kind of point to the areas that, that changed and then revert back. And what we think happened here is that the storm, that there's this very large cloud system on that appeared on Titan, rained out onto the surface. So on Titan, at Titan's temperatures, this is methane rain, and that it just dampened the surface. This is a huge area. The changes extend 2,000 kilometers east-west. That band is about 130 kilometers north-south. So the total area is 500,000 square kilometers. It's the size almost of the largest sea on Titan. So we don't think it's all flooded. In fact, we know it's not just flooding because we have a little bit of topographic information that shows that the dark areas aren't confined to the low areas. We think it's just that the surface got wet, and the fact that it brightened subsequently suggests that the surface is then drying out, or that the liquid is ponded in smaller areas or infiltrated down into the surface. There are a few areas, if you look in the right-hand panels, where we actually see brightening relative to the previous, the prior appearance. And it's possible that that is due to washing of the surface, that some of the areas have been washed clean from some of the hydrocarbon particulates that come out of the atmosphere. But that's another area that's under further study. The next slide just shows an example of this in Texas. This is an observation from Gemini 4, actually, and there's a large swath of dark area across Texas, and they correlated that with a rainstorm that had happened 24 hours before. So it seems that's what we've seen, and that suggests that this was quite a substantial storm, which is one of the reasons we're wondering if we'll see more, or if a lot of the methane in the atmosphere has been depleted and it will have to replenish and won't replenish until the storm systems move or the weather patterns move further to the north. Moving on to slide 10, another area where another part of Titan that is exhibiting changes as the seasons change is the upper atmosphere. Titan's atmosphere has a detached haze layer. You can see in these observations at very high phase angle this layer of haze, and then it gets dark before the atmosphere picks up again. And that's referred to as the detached haze layer. When Voyager observed Titan, this haze layer was at about 350 kilometers altitude. And when Cassini got there at a different season, it was up at 500 kilometers altitude. But last year, an observation from April 2010 shows that the haze has dropped again to about 380 kilometers. And the current season is actually fairly close to, it's a little past where Titan was in its year when Voyager encountered it. And when the two Voyagers flew by, it was late March, early April. And at the time of this observation, it was also early April. So that is consistent with the haze changing, the altitude of the haze changing as the circulation in the stratosphere changes as a result of the illumination changing due to the seasons changing. Slide 11 shows another exciting discovery on Titan in the last year. The upper corner, actually, the upper right corner, shows a comparison of Titan and Callisto. There's been a lot of discussion of whether Titan is endogenically active, whether there's internal tectonics and volcanism active on Titan, or whether it's actually effectively Callisto with weather, a mostly cratered body that has subsequently been eroded. And so there have been Jeff Moore and Bob Popolardo have done a lot of models to explore this possibility for Titan. And you can see that the terrain in Xanadu does look a lot like eroded eroded craters. And, of course, that's one of the things that the atmosphere and these rainstorms will lead to is erosion of the surface. This year there was a stereo observation recently of an area of Titan called Sotra Facula. So these are SAR observations, the synthetic aperture radar observations, but they're actually stereo, and so you can get topography information over a broad area from that. And the colored image on the lower left is illustrating the topography. The elevations are exaggerated by a factor of 10, and the colors in that are actually from VIMS observations. So the dark blues and browns are the spectra that are consistent with the dunes on Titan, and the yellows kind of map to these features that look like flows and to this this crater and the peak next to it. It's the peak. Let's see. The peak is about 1,000 meters high. The crater itself is about 1,500 meters deep. One of the best explanations for this would be that this is actually a cryovolcano. And what I showed for comparison is a cryovolcano on Io called Tohill Mons, where, again, you have the geometry is slightly rotated, but you have a high peak on Io. The peaks are much, much higher because it's a rocky body. And then a caldera next to it. That you could potentially have an impact crater right next to a mountain, but you start having to plead that's quite a special case that the impact, just when we only have a few impact craters that haven't been eroded on Titan, just happens to be preserved on the mountain. So especially that, combined with the fact that we see these flow-like features coming out from it, suggests that this may be indeed a cryovolcano, an ice volcano on Titan. There's also a video, I put a link here, with Rosalie Lopez discussing this observation, and it shows a flyover of the topography. It's really quite neat. So I'll move on quickly to some of the satellite highlights. There were three Enceladus flybys this year and a flyby of Rhea and Helene as well. I actually put in observations of some of the other satellites that we only observed distantly. We got some good views of Hyperion, slide 14. One of a few remaining views of Iapetus being very far out in the Saturnian system, it just wasn't possible to get another close flyby of Iapetus given the constraints on Cassini resources for the extended missions. So unfortunately, we only get a few more fairly distant views, and this was one from just last month. This is an observation of Tethys. Although we didn't have targeted flybys of many of the satellites, we did have non-targeted flybys. And this flyby of Tethys filled in some of the gaps in the map. So we have an updated map of the surface of Tethys. The areas at high northern latitudes that hadn't been seen well have been filled in by some of the observations from last August. And, of course, I couldn't resist putting in an image of Mimas and Herschel. There was a series of flybys of multiple satellites last fall. This is another non-targeted flyby, but there were some very good observations of Dione. You can see in the upper panel the wispy terrain that Voyager observed that's been revealed to be fracture systems running across the surface, and a nice central peak crater in the upper right. And again, the Dione map has also been updated this year with thanks to the new coverage we have. The 19th slide shows the updated Rhea map and a couple of recent observations of Rhea as well, including some of the lineaments across Rhea's surface. You can see these intersecting lines, some of which may be fractures or possibly rays from craters as well, extending across large areas of Rhea's surface. And there was a close flyby of Rhea last January. A couple of the higher resolution observations are shown on slide 20. You can see the cratered surface. But you can also see in the lower right-hand corner of that right-hand image some fractures, kind of muted fractures cutting across the surface. These observations are at several meters per pixel, so they're fairly high resolution, although they're fairly oblique looking off to the side. You can also see in that crater in the center that the materials change a little bit. There are different albedos in the materials, and you can see a kind of channel, a straight line running down the side of the crater, presumably mass wasting effect as material is slumping down into the interior of the crater. And moving on to slide 21, we have several targeted flybys of Enceladus over this past year, last August, November, and December. There are actually also several flybys coming up of Enceladus at the end of this year, quite a sequence in October and November. So this image from last August shows Enceladus. You see some of the plumes from the South Pole and the atmosphere of Saturn in the background. That's the sun coming through the atmosphere of Titan. The sun's on the The sun's on the other side of Enceladus and Saturn shining through the atmosphere there. You can tell which planet I study the most. The 22nd slide shows some observations from Ceres during the 13th August 2010 flyby, and they had some very high-resolution observations of the tiger stripes at the South Pole, revealing the temperatures within these cracks. And you can see, especially on the left-hand, upper left, you can see the map and how the temperatures kind of trace along the fractures and split at the ends as a result of how the fractures have developed. And this is helping us to understand the development of these tectonic features. Intriguingly, actually, there's a little area that's little red between the at the 70 degree, the minus 70 degree latitude line that just kind of stands out all on its own. This little isolated area of high temperature is particularly interesting. On the right, there's a higher resolution observation by Ceres revealing that the, as one might expect, the hottest temperatures are in the trench itself. This is the Damascus sulcus. The temperatures here actually get up to 190 kelvins, so that's really quite high for a body this far out in the solar system. The temperatures in between the tiger stripes are actually about 52 kelvins, and this is the South Pole, so it's going into winter and it will stop being illuminated, and the temperatures between the cracks will drop even further. Interestingly, the flanks are also somewhat elevated in temperature, so that helps us understand the distribution of the thermal energy along the fractures. There was another flyby of Enceladus last December. Enceladus, the South Pole, has the active tiger stripes, the jets of water vapor coming out. The higher northern latitudes, which are shown here, are actually much more heavily cratered. The craters look relaxed, so that suggests that the ice is warm enough that over geologic timescales, very long timescales, the ice is able to move. But nonetheless, this is much older terrain. The South Polar terrain, there are certainly no large impact craters and no really well-developed small craters either. You can see there are some fractures cutting across this area as well, and the rings are what's cutting across in the background of that image. And the 24th slide shows the boundary between the South Polar terrain that's very active and young. You can see there's a small impact crater there, and then the older, more cratered terrain which is nonetheless still being fractured. And you can see some of the fractures, especially down in the lower left, the fractures are focused through that crater. That seems to happen in a lot of places as a result of the stresses and the impact crater's effect on the stress in the lithosphere. The 25th slide summarizes some of the discoveries and papers that have been written about Enceladus in the past year. the Norbert talked about the UVIS images of the auroral footprint of Enceladus. So I won't go into detail on that given the time. The SEERS instrument, which had that observation, the very high-resolution observation of the temperatures along the fractures, also shows showed the total output of heat from Enceladus South Pole, which is almost 16 gigawatts. That's 2.5 times what of the heat output from Yellowstone on Earth. And what's illustrated here is that it's the equivalent of about 20 power stations. And you would expect from tidal heating and radioactive decay about 1 or 2 gigawatts. So there's a lot more energy coming out of Enceladus than one would predict, and that's what's leading to this great activity at the South Pole. It's led to questions, of course, where this energy is coming from. You wouldn't expect a lot of this much tidal heating from the interactions between Enceladus and Dione in a resonance around Saturn, but perhaps changes in the orbital relationship between the satellites over time can lead to changes in activity, in which case we just happen to be seeing Enceladus at a time when there's higher energy. This large amount of energy coming out of the South Pole or concentrated at the South Pole suggests or heightens the likelihood that there's liquid water there. And that's consistent with the observations from the CDA instrument identifying salt-rich ice grains in the plumes. Near Enceladus and some of the very close flybys, the plumes are very large and have quite a lot of sodium and potassium. And the best explanation to get that composition within the grains is that there is salt water within Enceladus. If you are somehow getting the plumes generated by just from solid ice, the solid ice, because salt will come out as you freeze salty water, the solid ice would have a much lower salt content. And so the fact that there's this much salt within the grain suggests that there's actually liquid water as the source of the plumes. And also suggests the water is in contact with the rocky core dissolving the salts below the ice mantle, and that there's a fairly large area exposed in order to get the jets that we observe, rather than just having if the area exposed were very small, it would just be able to freeze over at these low temperatures. So it seems like suggests at least that there would be a fairly large reservoir of salty water between the rocky core and an ice mantle in Enceladus, and then the jets come up through the fractures in the water ice lithosphere over the top. Excuse me. And then I'll finish with a particularly intriguing image of Helene. Helene is a co-orbital satellite with Dione. It's in the leading Lagrange point. We had a series of observations from last June that revealed a particularly intriguing surface on this very small body. It's about 30 kilometers across, and the mass-wasting processes that are occurring on the surface are just spectacular. You can see, this is slide 26, the downslope flow and erosion on the surface is incredibly dramatic and really quite intriguing and unexpected. The other side of Helene is mantled by regolith, but is cratered. And you can see there are craters here as well, but it's clearly dominated by the mass-wasting processes. So it's a particularly striking satellite. Saturn seems to be blessed with a lot of very spectacular small satellites. I guess we're heading into the eighth year. The summary slide is just shown again on slide 28, and there are several flybys coming up. As I mentioned, there are a number of Enceladus flybys this fall, and there are also several flybys of other satellites coming up. So we'll be continuing to monitor Titan as well and watch the weather there. So there's a lot more yet to come, hopefully. Thank you.
That's great, Zibi. Thanks a lot. Are there any quick questions for Zibi? What do you make of? Go ahead.
Yeah, hi, this is Lynn. I was just wondering if there's a reason that there are no Enceladus flybys between 2012 and 2016 or so.
I'd have to go back to the plot that Amanda showed about the with the inclination of Cassini's orbit.
That's the reason then, yeah, okay.
Depends on the inclination of the orbit. It's easier to get to the satellites at low inclinations than high inclinations.
Okay, thanks.
So I expect that correlates with the inclination, but I'd have to double-check the timing.
Any other questions?
Yeah, this is Ron. I have a couple of questions about Titan. First of all, on your slide about the global circulation, you show what looks to be cumulus clouds. Do you, in fact, have cumulus, I guess they would be made of methane droplets, clouds on Titan? And if so, do you have any idea how high they could get?
We do see convective activity in the cloud cells. In fact, the observation from the very first distant Titan flyby, just a couple days after orbit insertion, showed a cloud field that behaved for all the world like a field of little convective cumulus clouds on Earth. You know, they kind of pop up, and I say pop up, and we'd see the clouds kind of grow and shrink. We had a series of few images, and you could see some areas grow and some areas shrink, just like you'd see in a convective system on Earth. Observations by VIMS, which has much better spectral resolution, can get better constraints on the altitudes of the clouds, and those show the clouds rising. So again, the same kind of convective or behavior that you'd see in cumulus clouds on Earth. The clouds are generally within the troposphere, maybe extending into the lower stratosphere, so that's 30, 40 kilometers altitude. Some of them may be even lower.
And that would be similar to big cumulus clouds here on Earth. Do clouds here on Earth get into the stratosphere?
I think they do get into the stratosphere, but the altitudes are different on Earth. The atmosphere
right.
around Titan is much more extended.
Right, but in reference to the layers.
Yeah, in reference to the layers of the atmosphere, it's similar.
My other question has to do with the separate haze layer. Is that haze layer related to the North Polar Hood that I've heard about? And if so, are there changes now that the seasons are changing in the North Polar Hood? Or are we going to get a South Polar Hood?
Yes, exactly. So you can see, if you go actually to the second slide, you can see the North Polar Hood, and you can also see the detached haze layer at some latitudes. It's fainter at others. And the hood and there's a north-south asymmetry. You can't really see. You can kind of make it out, maybe depending on your monitor. In the brightness of Titan's atmosphere, the albedo of the atmosphere, and those will be shifting as well, or are in the process of shifting.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Sounds like maybe not. We should probably wrap it up anyway. We've gone pretty long today. So I'd like to thank everybody for hanging in there. I'd like to thank Zibby. That was really interesting. And thank all our other speakers as well. A reminder for participants, we'll hear about the rings next month from Jeff Cuzzy. It'll be the last final part of our Charm Anniversary Telecon. So join us in August. And I think we'll call it a day. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Bye.